First case on our docket is Quest versus Blood and Public Service Company. Are both parties present, ready? Thank you. Let me take care of a few housekeeping matters before we start. The case is set for an hour. The first is Justice Coates will not participate in this case. The second is that Justice Designate Marquez will be joining the court on December 10th. And absent an issue of conflict that she may determine later, if there is such a conflict, she will participate in the decision in this case and listen to the tapes and so forth. So I would ask which of you to, when you start your argument, to please state your name for the record. And I also would ask the respondents, have you decided how you're going to allot your time? Mr. Keating?
We agreed to divide it by 20 minutes for Mr. Blood and 10 minutes for XL.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lepsack.
And may I ask just one housekeeping matter?
Sure.
The court set the timer for 5 minutes before the end of my 20.
I don't think we can do that, and I'm sorry, Mr. Keating. One of the rules up here is you'll have to watch your own time.
Fair enough. Thanks.
All right. So let's hear from the petitioners. Mr. Kerwin.
I am Craig Kerwin, counsel for Quest. May it please the court. I want to begin with two important points before we discuss the legal issues in this case. First, at this trial, Quest looked to the jury like an evil, uncaring company that deserved to be punished, not because of what it did or did not do at the time Mr. Blood was injured in June 2004, but rather because Blood's counsel vilified Quest for failing to take remedial measures during the 3 years after the accident that injured Mr. Blood. And the second point is that poll 5905, at the time Mr. Blood was injured, was not an ordinary poll. It was a freestanding pole. All of the electric and the telephone wires that were normally attached to it had been removed 1 week before, and a guy wire that held it up had been removed. And that is what made pole 5905 hazardous to Mr. Blood or to anyone who happened to climb on it. And that is not a normal situation for the 157,000 Quest poles in Colorado. And the people who were within the zone of danger to pole 5905 during that time were linemen like the Excel crew who have special training in how to deal with wood poles. They're aware of the hazards that wood poles can rot. They know that they should tap with a hammer. They should prod with a screwdriver to detect hidden rot. If they're uncertain, they should take special steps like adding guy wires back in, as Excel rules require, but weren't followed here. Or they use a bucket truck, like the bucket truck that was across the street when this accident happened. So poll 5905, for purposes of your de novo review of whether Quest conduct deserved to be punished to the tune of $18 million, was no ordinary poll, and Mr. Blood was no ordinary victim or member of the public at that time. And that made this situation unique, something of a freestanding accident. Now, unless this court intervenes, the lesson to lawyers from this trial is that you can score a record-breaking punitive damage award in Colorado if you ignore the trial court's in limine ruling, keeping certain evidence out, and try the case your way. And you don't have to read much of the record to get a sense of this. If you look at the discussion between trial counsel and the judge before the trial got underway on the first day of trial, May 14th, and the first two witnesses, you will see that it was crystal clear to plaintiffs that they should not violate the in limine ruling and talk about Quest's inspection practices after the accident.
Mr. Kerwin,
yes?
Can I ask you a question that troubled me? One is that it's pretty clear the post-accident issue was not appealed. It was a mistrial. It's an evidentiary matter. At least that's what Judge Webb found in the Court of Appeals. And secondly, could you explain to me how the post-accident, your argument about post-accident, misconduct, deals or concerns or equates with potential harm to others? Because I just don't quite understand that.
Your Honor, just to make sure I address your second question, intentional harm to others is critical for punitive damages, but I'm not clear on what you're asking me. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't understand how the post-accident the statement, closing argument, whether or not it's open the door or not, and so forth, has anything to do with the cert questions, and I don't understand how it relates to specifically the issue of your claim about the exemplary damages.
Okay, the first
question. So you're using the Philip Morris case, basically.
Okay, Chief Justice Bender, the first question that I understand is how did Quest preserve this argument under Philip Morris for review by this court? And the Court of Appeals refused to review this issue because it found that Quest had not requested a specific Philip Morris jury instruction. And based on that, they said Quest waived the right to bring this issue to this court. And I submit it doesn't take a complicated reading of Philip Morris to see that Philip Morris doesn't say anything about how you have to request a jury instruction so the jury can separate out evidence that might be appropriate for consideration of reprehensibility and evidence that might be appropriate for calculating punitive damages. It says states must provide protections upon request. That's the holding of Philip Morris, and it leaves it to states flexibility about how that request should be carried out. Here, what Quest did instead of a jury.
You're saying more than that, though, aren't you? I mean, certainly, would you agree that one of our options to adopt procedures would be if you request a Philip Morris instruction, then you get one?
Justice Martinez, clearly trial courts need guidance here, and I see that being one of the results of this case if the court reaches those issues. And one,
you're saying we should do more than that.
Yes, in the context of
as a matter of state authority, not compelled by Morris.
Well, I think Philip Morris compels this court to take certain actions to make sure that those protections are there. And I do want to get back to Chief Justice Bender's question. But one of those clearly is an appropriate jury instruction. And what I'm here to advocate is that you adopt the reasoning of the dissent of Judge Richman and go a few steps beyond. But Judge Richman pointed out that he would allow a jury instruction clarifying the use of the evidence that can be considered for reprehensibility but not for purposes of calculating.
And I didn't want to distract you from answering the question. I just wanted to put it in that. In context.
It's okay. I like Justice Martinez's question.
Chief Justice Bender, I want to circle back. I feel like I didn't answer the second half of your question, which is, in essence, why are we here and what does Philip Morris have to do with this case? Philip Morris.
That's Philip Morris. Your argument about post-accident conduct.
You're on a post-accident.
I understand how Philip Morris, I think, at least somewhat understand that.
Post-accident conduct could not have related to harm to Andrew Blood. He was already injured. It had to relate to harm to others. And in this case, potential harm, because there was no evidence of actual harm. And that's right at the heart of what Philip Morris is directing state courts to address. Courts cannot allow juries to consider harm to others or potential harm to others when calculating the amount of punitive damages. And yet right in the
middle. And you say Philip Morris says that? The way you just phrased it?
Your Honor, I believe Philip Morris makes it very clear that juries may not consider harm to others in calculating the amount of punitive damages, yes.
Don't they deal with reprehensibility?
That kind of evidence can be considered in certain circumstances when special protections are made for reprehensibility. In this trial, the trial judge at the beginning on a motion in limine, which was the method of protection that Quest sought, took a different approach, and she sought to keep that evidence out entirely. There was not an argument that evidence should come in post-accident evidence for purposes of reprehensibility, but not for purposes of calculating the damages. She said in her in limine ruling, all that evidence stays out. And yet the way this trial unfolded, that evidence rapidly came in long before the finding about opening the door. It came in because of questions from plaintiff's counsel who refused to accept that in limine ruling and broadcast that to the jury. And there's no question that the jury got it because the very first question they asked of the court through the court process had to do with the post-accident budget that Quest, if Quest had more money, would they spend it on pole inspection? So the jury got it. And then by the time we got to closing arguments, it is the theory of the case for the plaintiffs that nothing tells you more about Quest's culpability here but what happened after the accident. And so, plainly, the reason Quest was punished here wasn't because of what it had done at the time Mr. Blood was injured, but because of what it had done afterwards, which was an unfair way to set this
up. But the 50 years of non-maintenance of the poles does come in, right?
Your Honor, Quest did not object to the pre-accident maintenance of the poles and the evidence about that, although it didn't say it was non-maintenance. They had plenty of employees out there replacing poles, marking hazardous poles. The focus of the motion in limine was on the post-accident after June 29, 2000.
So it's an inflammatory sort of even in contempt of court maybe. statements by counsel, you're saying that inflame the jury?
Counsel,
that's what the issue is.
Counsel was not held in contempt. The Quest did move for a mistrial, and rather than granting that mistrial, the court, this is after closing arguments, the court recognized that evidence should not have come in, and she tried to cure it with an instruction that we say could not possibly have undone things. And that's the instruction she gave, which essentially retreated to her in limine ruling that you shall not consider post-accident evidence. This would have been a radically different trial if it had been limited as the court envisioned and as Quest envisioned to what Quest did before June 29, 2004. No one had been hurt by falling poles at that time. As I said at the beginning, this was a freestanding pole. It was unique. And so it would have been to punish Quest for something that had never happened before when they thought that they had an adequate...
Mr. Kerwin, is it relevant to the contract claim that you had against Public Service Company?
Is the post-accident evidence relevant?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, that was the rationale for the opening the door, is that Quest counsel asked one question having to do with continued payments between Quest and Excel under the joint use contract that occurred after the accident.
Oh, did you seek, as I think the respondents point out, a separate trial on the contract claim?
There was no request for bifurcation before this trial, Your Honor.
So it was admissible on post-accident evidence was admissible, at least against Excel? That's what you asked for, your client asked for?
Your Honor, the court found that the post-accident evidence shouldn't come in, that it was unfairly prejudicial, it was not relevant to the case. At the time that the Quest counsel asked one question about payments, the court found that the door had been opened. I would submit the court should adopt the reasoning of Judge Richman in dissent that this has nothing to do with opening the door. Opening the door is about completing the factual picture for the jury on something where they would otherwise be misled. And the opening the door, as it related to the contract claim between Excel and Quest, had nothing to do with punitive damages against Quest. But immediately plaintiff's counsel ran through that door and used it for a different purpose. So, but you're right, Your Honor, that there was an opening at the trial in terms of the evidence because of the contract claim. Fort Morris doesn't give state courts an option in terms of providing these constitutional protections when they were requested. And we submit that they were clearly requested in the in limine ruling, and the in limine ruling was granted. And the best indication to this court of how tainted this trial was is to look at the trial court's ruling troubling the damages, which is not in front of you because the Court of Appeals took care of that. But there, the trial court, relying on the very evidence that was not supposed to come in at all, the post-accident evidence, found there was substantial proof of Quest bad behavior, and she tripled the punitive damages. So having allowed a trial where only one side of the evidence came in, plaintiff's side, not Quest's side, about that post-accident conduct, she then found by the end of the trial the evidence was overwhelming about that. That's why this trial was tainted, and that's why this jury's punitive damage award also should be set aside, just like the Court of Appeals set aside the trebling order. And that does come from Philip Morris. Philip Morris builds on other Supreme Court cases, of course, but it is the one that is most direct, and it says we are announcing a new rule about harm to others, and we don't want juries punishing a defendant based on events that could involve other parties with entirely different facts. That's why this case falls squarely within Philip Morris, is because the post-accident evidence had to relate to someone other than Andrew Blood, and it was potential harm because there was no evidence of Quest falling any time after June 2004 through the date of this trial.
Mr. Kerwin, you said at the beginning of your comments earlier that you agreed with the dissent, except that you thought it should have gone farther in this respect. Could you tell me what you meant by that, please?
By further, Your Honor, I have in mind that I think this court needs to face the constitutionality of the Colorado punitive damages statute, and we've clearly briefed that. The dissent and the majority in the Court of Appeals found ways to require, as Justice Martinez mentioned, some kind of a mandatory jury instruction, and to follow the Bennett versus Greeley gas case, which bars evidence about post-accident conduct for punitive damages. But I think that this court should consider and unfortunately strike down the Colorado punitive damages statute. And the reasoning is simple. Colorado has said in the Corbetta versus Albertson case from this court that punitive damages are a creature of statute, not common law. So it should be the General Assembly, not this court, not the trial courts, putting limits on what punitive damages are allowed. And this statute, unfortunately, specifically refers in the definition of willful and wanton to the rights and safety of others. And it puts no constraints on how that evidence will be used. Trial judges, first.
I just want to be clear. Are you suggesting that if, as I asked you about earlier, we simply adopted the procedure of an instruction, a Morris instruction, when requested, you are not, in terms of your argument that the statute itself is unconstitutional, you would say that that act by us is unwarranted, that we actually can't do that corrective action because it would essentially correct the statute, which is the prerogative of the legislature? Is that the argument you're making?
Yes, Justice Martinez, I think that would be a logical extension of this court's precedence before, saying punitive damages exist by statute. If in this ruling this court says that it is appropriate for Colorado to put common law limits on punitive damages in light of federal constitutional rights, for example, then you might well get to it.
Isn't that what we do all the time, is instruct regarding trial procedure, instruct regarding how different statutes and constitutional principles may interact? I mean, it's difficult for me to understand that suddenly we're without that ability because it's legislative prerogative.
I agree, Your Honor, that that's very common. But in this case, when there's a plain reading to a statute, this court tries to apply that plain reading. The statute defines willful and wanton conduct, and it says you shall consider the rights and safety of others, and it doesn't give any context to that. And so a trial court starting tomorrow with a punitive damages claim would be figuring out, how do I tell the jury about what willful and wanton means in the context of punitive damages? Of course, I turn to the statute. That's what the General Assembly has told me to do. And the willful and wanton definition tells me I should tell the jury to consider the rights and safety of others. If the Colorado Supreme Court says, no, you should not use that definition, instead you should say you will only consider the rights and safety of others when the trial judge has weighed the evidence and determined that there will not be prejudice from considering harm to others in the context of reprehensibility but not damages, or some formula like that, then maybe you can get there. But I think that...
Well, what about this argument that it's the actual damages of others you can't introduce? Certainly the General Assembly must have had in mind that there are cases where persons or corporations act willfully and wantonly and should suffer a deterrent consequence, deterring others, deterring their own conduct, requiring reformation of the conduct. I mean, all of those are public policies that seem to have utility.
And Justice Hobbs, I agree with your impression about the General Assembly. It's not in front of you today, but the troubling portion invites the trial court to consider the actions during the pendency of the case, which by definition are after the accident, in order to increase the punitive damages. And it's not in front of you now, but I would submit that that's plainly unconstitutional in light of Philip Morris, because that is actual harm to others. And the reason for this, you go back to the BMW versus Gore case, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, is saying, we don't want arbitrary punitive damage awards. We want predictability. You should know what the conduct is you can be punished for, and you should know what the approximate amount of that punishment would be. And maybe Quest deserved some punishment here for what it did with respect to Andy Blood, but not with respect to some other Excel crew on some...
Well, how do we separate that out, though? I mean,
Philip Morris doesn't give as clear guidance as it could, but it says states must provide that assurance.
Well, a remittiture, a reduction of the amount, if it's excessively and shockingly in excess, shows passion and emotion on part of the jury that shouldn't be in the process. Why isn't that within our authority to reduce the award?
I think it is here, Your Honor, and many trial courts in the federal system particularly have done that, where they've looked at what is an appropriate punitive award, and they've looked at the conduct and seen how culpable it is or is not, and said within this range, we think that, say, a one-to-one ratio of compensatories to punitives is too severe. The Chamber of Commerce in their amicus brief has a whole footnote cataloging these cases where courts have reduced it to maybe 50% of the compensatory award. And certainly if this court does not strike down the punitive award altogether, in this case, for the reasons I explained, this was a freak accident involving a freestanding pole where there happened to be harm to people during that week. The guy wire had been removed. That's not the same as 157,000 poles of Quest posing a risk to the public at large. And that's why if one-to-one is the maximum in Colorado that a jury can award as punitive damages, and it is, and we're almost at one-to-one here with $21 million in compensatories and $18 million in punitives, why should Quest be conduct in this case be at the extreme end of that one-to-one when there had never been a person injured like this before? They thought that they were inspecting poles in the context of routine maintenance, and this freak accident happened because a pole had its guy wire removed, and an Excel lineman chose to climb that pole instead of having the bucket truck across the street take off the crossbar. This is not extreme conduct, and in our view, it doesn't meet the reprehensibility factors under federal due process law that warrant a punitive damage award in the first place. And in the BMW case and others, the courts have articulated factors for what is reprehensible, and five of them would be physical harm. We clearly have that here. Another would be indifference to the health and safety of others. And here, in this instance, a freestanding pole wasn't indifference to the safety of all of Colorado. It may have been indifference to an Excel crew that came up but didn't properly inspect it. So I would suggest that factor goes in our favor. The other three, whether the victim was financially vulnerable, nothing to do with this case. No one suggests that Quest intended to harm Andrew Blood. Repeated actions versus an isolated incident. This had never happened before to Quest. That doesn't fit. And intentional malice.
Repeated actions. Wasn't there plenty of evidence? And didn't you admit that prior to the accident that there was rot in many of the poles and you hadn't inspected it and so forth? I thought you admitted that.
Your Honor, repeated actions would be when there are accidents.
You mean when the pole fell?
When a pole falls.
Unfortunately, the pole fell only once.
Wood poles will rot. That's obvious to everyone, including linemen. That's what they learn about in lineman school. A pole can be rotten. It can be completely disconnected and not falling on anyone because it has guy wires and telephone wires and electric wires on it. And that could be a problem when someone goes to remove it, but it's not going to fall on anyone at all. And so what matters is not that wood rots. We all know from science class that that's the case. And that's why linemen take all of these precautions to tap and to prod. That's not a surprise. In this instance, you're suggesting that Quest admitted it had not been inspecting poles in some routine way. And the evidence...
That suggests repeated conduct to me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
It suggests repeated conduct that wasn't causing harm to anyone, Your Honor. And it wasn't causing, from the Public Utilities Commission point of view, it wasn't causing disruptions in phone service, which is the main thing that regulation of Quest care, that the regulators of Quest care about, because the lines that Quest carries are not a hazard to anyone. So the plaintiffs ripped up the jury into a fear over the lack of a periodic inspection program when they couldn't show any specific requirement in Colorado law that even called for that. The reference in Colorado law to through the Public Utility Commission regulations and through the contract was to the National Electric Safety Code. And that code doesn't call for inspections on a certain schedule. It leaves it to the discretion of the utility to maintain its pole plant in a safe and serviceable way, in their discretion on how to do it. So when you look at regulatory standards, which is what a company should be guided about in deciding whether to avoid a penalty or not, there was nothing before this Quest accident, and I submit there's nothing now, saying you shall inspect on a regular schedule. That's what the plaintiffs used in this case to whip the jury into a furor and to rely on all this post-accident conduct to get the jury angry. I'm going to try to reserve some time.
I would actually like you to answer one question, and that is, if I understand right, you are not saying that the testimony about the rights and safeties of others it has to be prohibited altogether. This is very narrow in this particular case. In terms of your argument that the statute is unconstitutional, and particularly I think you're pointing at the definition of willful and wanton conduct, I guess what I'd like to know is how, in your view, would that language be corrected to be constitutional and still take into account the rights and safety of others in the limited manner in which, in your view, it is permissible?
I agree with
that. The easy answer to your question is, well, you eliminate rights and safety. But if you want to maintain that to the extent feasible, how do you do it?
If the correction is coming from the legislature, I would go back to the pre-tort reform formula, which did not define willful and wanton. We cite this in a footnote, and it left that to decision by trial courts based on their knowledge. In this instance, the legislature could pull back from trying to micromanage the process and leave it to the trial judges to decide how to handle harm about rights and safety to others in the context of a particular trial, and to keep within Philip Morris. And the the U.S. Supreme Court case law has been...
You know, a little tension there between that argument and your previous position that the court shouldn't by Morris instruction or by trial procedure, make this statute work constitutionally?
Your Honor, we are suggesting that the statute doesn't work because of its explicit reference, and it's unconstitutional on its face. Short of that, it's unconstitutional as applied here because all of this evidence came in. In terms of how to fix it, I think this court could pull back from the position in Corbetta versus Albertson and say not every aspect of punitive damages is statutory, and as supervisors of the trial courts in this state, we will make sure that federal constitutional rights are followed. And I think you could fix this along the lines of what you just articulated, by giving trial courts discretion to make sure that the federal right is honored. Here, this trial judge didn't even try that balancing. She chose to keep all of this evidence out in her in limine ruling, and yet that wasn't followed here. That was breached repeatedly.
Well, how's that a fault of the statute? I don't understand the way we're waiting to hear from the other side. But, apparently it's violation of the court's order. That's what you're arguing. You know, it was in excess of the in limine ruling, and it was bad conduct by counsel. That's what I'm hearing. So
that's right.
Correct my impression if I'm wrong about
it. I do not blame the statute for how this trial unfolded, Your Honor. I think this court got it right on her in limine ruling, and what happened is that trial counsel for plaintiffs refused to honor that in limine ruling in an abusive way where it was obvious to this jury what had happened.
Well, that's just a collection of the process, then, that courts can do, right? I mean... The statute still has some public policy behind it.
Yes, the awkward thing, if in your decision, I would urge you to give trial courts guidance about what to do when they define willful and wanton conduct if the statute is not amended, because it does specifically refer to rights and safety of others. And with the authority of this court, trial courts can be very comfortable trying to apply a Philip Morris kind of approach. And maybe there's a way to pull back and not declare the statute unconstitutional. I'm going to try to reserve some time for rebuttal. I have about 5 minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Kerwin.
If it pleases the court, I'm Bill Keating, and I am counsel representing Andrew and Kitty Blood. The jury decided to punish Quest in this case because the evidence of Quest's willful and wanton conduct was very clear. Quest had a decades-long practice of failing to comply with its duty to inspect its utility poles throughout the state of Colorado. Quest stipulated that there was no evidence it had ever inspected pole 5905, the pole on which Mr. Blood was injured, in the 46 years it was in place. And Quest stipulated it had no evidence of any periodic inspection program being conducted by it. 20 years after it acknowledged its responsibility to inspect, in the joint utility agreement, in June of 1980, Quest decided, finally, to do a sampling of poles in Denver to see what the condition of those poles was and to remediate, repair, or remove. Barely 3 weeks after signing that contract, it was canceled by Quest supervisors, and never again did Quest engage in any inspection program.
Well, I understand that's not in contest. What's in contest is the in limine ruling and the conduct that brought in evidence that wasn't supposed to be there, or at least questions that suggested the evidence. So would you go to that point,
sure,
please?
Let me address that to Justice Hobbs. The Court of Appeals addressed this as well. The Court of Appeals counted a total of 6 questions over an 8-day trial, which were objected to and sustained regarding the time frame of Quest's conduct. The first witness call was a Quest employee, Mark Schmidt. Blood instructed the witness that whenever questions are asked regarding Quest's historical conduct, those questions should be answered only for the period of June 29, 2004 and earlier. Blood instructed the second witness, Mr. Dollenhauer, a Quest expert or a Quest employee, to do the same. Blood repeatedly, in questioning Dr. McIntyre, Blood's expert on pole safety, limited the testimony to the pre-accident. Quest, by the way, asked a lot of questions regarding its post-accident conduct of Mr. Dollenhauer, how they were inspecting, the type of inspections they did today,
But in any event, the court found that none of that prejudiced the defendant. The court denied a judgment or a motion for new trial based on that issue. And the court ruled that Quest had opened the door to the evidence. There is nothing in either Philip Morris or in any other United States Supreme Court case dealing with punitive damage jurisprudence which puts any limit based on due process or evidentiary limit on the consideration of post-accident conduct for purposes of reprehensibility. In fact, a quote from TXO versus Alliance Resources, I think, gives us a good sense of the court's view. And in TXO Products versus Alliance Resources Corp., the court said, it is appropriate to consider the magnitude of the potential harm that the defendant's conduct would have caused if its intended victim, or to its intended victim, if the wrongful plan had succeeded, as well as the possible harm to other victims that might have resulted if similar future behavior were not deterred. There is no due process violation here with regards to the court's decision to permit the introduction of post-accident conduct. Regarding, I'd like to talk just a second, if I might, if I've adequately answered the question.
Could you just explain to me how the door was opened by Quest?
Sure.
And what part of the trial portion?
Quest had, this was in Quest's presentation part of the trial. Quest recalled Mr. Schmidt. And Quest had Mr. Schmidt talk a lot about the contract between Excel and Quest, and then had him testify that Quest continues to send bills for rent for its poles to public service, Excel, and Excel continues to pay them. And they talked about that for a while. And the importance of that is that Quest was contesting a contractual claim that its failure to inspect for the 46 years, actually, its failure to inspect all the way up until the date of trial, was a material breach of the contract. Everyone approached the court for a bench conference. The court heard argument, and the court said, you can ask a single question regarding post-accident. Blood's counsel was the next party up for the questioning, and Blood's counsel asked that single question, and that was the extent of it. Quest then put on a witness from James Downey, I believe this is his last name, from Excel, and spent pages of transcript questioning him about Excel's failure to engage in poll inspections in the period between June 29, 2004 and the date of the trial. And this became a big focus of Quest's closing argument, because Quest said the fact that public service is also not inspecting polls up to today tells us it's not a material breach. This became a big part of their defense. There was no prejudice to Quest by the admission of post-accident evidence. With regards to the facial attack on the constitutionality of this statute, the Supreme Court in BMW versus Gore and State Farm versus Campbell said that an important factor to consider for purposes of evaluating the degree of reprehensibility is whether the tortious conduct, quote, evinces an indifference to or a reckless disregard of the health and safety of others. In Colorado, the statute directs the jury to consider whether the conduct was done heedlessly and recklessly, without regard to consequences, or of the rights and safety of others. Language virtually identical to the language used by the Supreme Court. This statute is not unconstitutional because the jury is directed to consider a factor that the United States Supreme Court says should be considered. And the importance of this factor was reaffirmed by the court in Philip Morris when the court said, and I'm quoting, "We recognize that conduct that risks harm to many is likely more reprehensible than conduct that risks harm to only a few. And a jury consequently may take this fact into account in determining reprehensibility." In its as-applied attack, what Quest seeks to do is take the trial court's discretionary rulings on the opening the door and the admission of post-accident evidence and on the denial of the motion for mistrial and elevate those discretionary rulings to a denial of due process. There is not a single case that supports that theory. The trial court here, or the Court of Appeals here, determined that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in ruling that Quest had opened the door and in permitting the introduction of post-accident evidence. And the Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying a motion for mistrial based on comments Blood made in the initial closing, but rather the trial court gave an instruction limiting that. Rather than ask for or petition for certiorari on that aspect of the case, what Quest seeks to do is turn those decisions into an unconstitutional application of this of our punitive damage statute and a denial of due process rights. There is nothing in Philip Morris nor in any other case cited by Quest which supports a theory that it is a denial of due process to permit the consideration of post-accident conduct for purposes of mental state, purposes of determining the need to punish, purposes of determining the need to deter.
Skeedy, on that, not on that factual point, not legal point, what about the sufficiency of the evidence that, that Mr. Kerwin argues in terms of the second issue, that there really isn't, in our de novo review, that there is not, there was not sufficient evidence of punitive damages, and he cites the guy wires being down and not, you know, being used and all the other, whatever, 150,000 poles and so forth.
So, let me address that. This court, in doing its de novo review of the amount of the award for purposes of the substantive due process rights regarding grossly excessive awards, does, however, look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And what we have here, first, with regards to the guy wire, Quest removed the guy wire. Secondly, with regards to other incidents, Mr. Downauer testified there had been other pole failures. He knew that. But because Quest had a business practice of not keeping any records of when a pole failed, why the pole failed, the consequences of the pole failure, he had no idea what happened as a result of pole failures or how many they had, because it was a business practice not to keep such records. With regards to the sufficiency of the evidence of punitive damages, the evidence, I think, is quite clear. First, Quest admitted, this comes from their witnesses, this case was essentially proved through Quest's own employees and Quest's own expert, Ronald Anthony, a pole safety expert from Fort Collins. Quest admitted it knew it had a duty to inspect poles. It knew that if poles weren't inspected, inevitably, poles would develop rot. And typically, the rot is below ground and is hidden. Quest agreed that if a pole develops rot, it loses structural integrity. And if a pole fails as a result of loss of structural integrity, there is a substantial risk of serious injury, death, or serious property damage. Quest admitted that it had not engaged in any periodic inspection program, admitted it did not tell Excel that it was not engaging in periodic inspection program. Mr. Downauer and Mr. Anthony both testified Quest had no justification for not engaging in a periodic inspection program. The evidence was so clear that in closing, Quest told the jury, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but not much, "We wish we had a reason to give you for not having a periodic inspection program, but we don't." The idea that Quest reasonably relied on its pre-climb inspection program as a substitute is contradicted in the record and was rejected.
So you're saying basically the pre-accident evidence supports the punitive damages award?
The pre-accident evidence was overwhelming, 46 years.
And the amount?
And the amount okay. as well.
So the issue then is whether this post-accident evidence came in, whether it was prejudicial, whether it inflamed the jury, whether it was excessive, things that you would say would be in our de novo review, but bound by the evidence in the record, that was admissible?
Based on Quest's decision not to petition this court for a review of whether the trial court abused its discretion in admitting the evidence, the review, I believe, is limited to a due process review, because that's what Quest claims. Quest claims it was a denial of due process for the court to admit evidence of post-accident conduct. In fact, Quest claims it didn't receive any protection from the jury's consideration of post-accident conduct potential harm to others. In fact, the trial court gave Quest all the protection it asked for, because the trial court told the jury, "You may only consider evidence before June 29, 2004 in relation to punitive damages." And I believe we must presume that the jury followed that instruction. The evidence of post-accident conduct is not deemed prejudicial based on Colorado's jurisprudence. Palmer versus Robbins, this court held that evidence of post-accident conduct can be admissible to prove things such as intent, motive, that is, whether that you meet the willful and wanton standard. Cole versus Dow Chemical, a court of appeals case, held the same. And it is relevant because the argument is, from Quest, "We had no idea this could happen." Implicit in the argument is, "If we had known, we wouldn't have done it." Well, it is relevant then to say, all right, what did you do after you saw it could happen? And if the answer is, well, we just continued doing the same thing, that contradicts, it impeaches the argument that we were acting reasonably before. It is a reasonable consideration. And the Supreme Court, although it has never specifically addressed post-accident conduct, the Supreme Court has said that repeated conduct, recidivist conduct, is an important factor to consider when judging the degree of reprehensibility. And here, the degree of reprehensibility is high.
Keating, can I just ask you about that? Mr. Kerwin's argument basically is that this is an isolated action under the relevant factor under B&W. So what were the, in other words, you know, if the, because no one else was injured, because he took the guy wires down, this was just Mr. Blood's problem and not 157,000 poles, whatever it is. So how do you get to the repeated action that caused indifference to the safety of others? And he, according to what he said, at least I think he said, was basically this one pole problem and not a large pole problem. That's how I interpret what he was saying.
If the evidence was that Quest inspected its poles routinely, did everything it should, and nevertheless a pole failed, it's a good argument that that's not punitive, that's not willful and wanton conduct. However, if the evidence was, as it was here, that Quest over a 46-year period had failed to perform somewhere in the several hundred thousands of pole inspections. And pole inspections are safety inspections. The longer you fail to conduct periodic safety inspections, the more inevitable it is that someone will be hurt. It is true there was no evidence of actual harm to others, but there was evidence that there had been other pole failures. And the reason that evidence couldn't be expanded is that Quest had a business practice of not keeping any record of why those poles failed. But this is not a freak accident. This is an inevitable accident. It's inevitable from engaging in the repeated conduct of breaching the duty that Quest admitted it had. And that's an important factor for reprehensibility. The fact that the injury was physical and catastrophically so is an important factor to consider in raising the degree of reprehensibility. The fact the conduct evinced a reckless disregard of the rights and safety of others is an important factor. And Quest's witnesses admitted that when poles are not inspected, inevitably, they will develop rot and lose structural integrity, and a pole that loses structural integrity exposes the general public as well as linemen to the risk of serious injury, death, or serious property damage. The fourth factor, I think, that enhances the degree of reprehensibility is that Quest's conduct was hard to detect. Quest never admitted, never told Excel, we're not doing these inspections. And the result of Quest's conduct was the development of below-ground hidden fungus rot. And the final factor that enhances, I believe, is that the evidence would support a conclusion that Quest's violation of its duty to inspect for all these decades augmented its profits because Quest did not pay for the kind of inspection program it was obligated to have. The next issue in that three-pronged consideration of a de novo review of the amount of the award after reprehensibility, and here there's high degree of reprehensibility, is the ratio. The ratio here is less than 1-1. There is nothing about the amount of the jury's award which would tell us the jury was infected. A jury is not told in Colorado that there's a statutory limit of 1-1. An inflamed jury, for example, could say, we're going to give punitive damages of 10, 20, 30 times. We see that in these appellate cases. There's no evidence here that the jury was inflamed. The jury gave an award of less than 1-1. So the ratio is consistent with the constitutionally permissible range of an award. And that's what the court is reviewing de novo. Is the amount within a constitutionally permissible range? As Judge Posner said in Mathias versus a core lodging case, the appellate court polices a range and not a point. And this amount is well within that range for this degree of reprehensibility. Regarding this reference to PUC regulations, there is not a single bit of evidence in the record regarding PUC regulations. Quest never introduced it. Quest never talked about it. All of this is post-verdict. When this court reviews de novo, it reviews the jury verdict de novo. I believe that a de novo review of the jury verdict cannot include evidence that the jury was never given to consider, evidence that was never tested in the courtroom by direct and cross-examination. On the one further issue on the as-applied, Quest never asked for any protection against the jury's consideration of its pre-accident conduct for the potential harm to others, 46 years of it. Quest never said to the trial court, we want a motion in limine on that, or we want a jury instruction that limits the jury considering that to reprehensibility. And there's no basis for giving such an award or such a limiting instruction because the court in Philip Morris was concerned with actual harm to others. The court repeatedly says actual harm to others. concerned that the jury might consider actual harm to others in determining the amount, which is not permissible, rather than in determining reprehensibility, which is permissible. There is no case cited by Quest that says that a trial court must give an instruction limiting consideration of potential harm to others. And finally, what the court in Philip Morris makes clear is that it's the duty of the defendant to request protection. Quest requested no protection for 46 years worth of that pre-accident testimony. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm John Lebsack, and I represent Public Service in this case. I would first like to talk about why, if the issues that are before this court involve punitive damages, why is Public Service still involved in this case? The court denied certiorari on the issues that were proposed that affected the claims against Public Service. And the court granted certiorari only on two issues that relate to punitive damages. As you know, the first issue is, does the punitive damage award against Quest violate due process? Second issue, did the Court of Appeals err in affirming the punitive damage award? Now, let's consider the cert issues that were denied, and these are the issues that involve Public Service. The court denied certiorari on a proposed issue of, did the Court of Appeals err by affirming the denial of a new trial on the jury finding that Quest was 100% at fault? And the court also denied certiorari on the issue of whether there was error in finding that Quest breached a material term of the joint use contract. Now, those are the only proposed cert issues that involved the contract claims against Public Service, and those were denied. Now, let's consider rulings by the Court of Appeals that were either not requested for review on cert, or if they were requested, cert was denied. So the Court of Appeals found that there was no error in the trial court's ruling that Quest had opened the door, and therefore counsel could ask a single question about post-accident conduct. The Court of Appeals held there was no error in denying a mistrial based on alleged violations of the motion in limine, or the order in limine. There was no error in denying a mistrial based on the contents of closing argument. There was sufficient evidence to support the verdict that Quest breached a material term of the contract. There was sufficient evidence that Quest was 100% negligent. And there was sufficient evidence that Mr. Blood and Public Service were not negligent. But despite that, and despite those rulings that are now, I believe, law of the case, Quest is arguing that constitutional errors somehow require a new trial on all issues, not just limited to punitive damages, but also involving the contract claims and the compensatory award. And we submit that even if this court finds there was some error in regard to punitive damages, there's no reason to remand for a new trial on anything other than punitive damages. So the general rule that this court has recognized in a long series of cases on what is the scope of a new trial involves whether the issues are separate and distinct. It's a basic issue of fairness. If the issues that involve the error are separate from the issues that were not affected by the error, then the new trial just goes back on the issues that were affected by the error. There are cases.
Mr. Lebsack, isn't that necessarily dependent upon us rejecting the notion that the Morris principles relate as well to the evidentiary rulings as Mr. Kerwin argued? In other words, if we accept his position that Morris considerations should have governed evidentiary decisions and limitations on closing argument, which I think he is implying, if not stating directly, then that casts your notion that the only the punitive damages portion of the trial and not the not the merits are at issue.
I believe that the due process is limited to the punitive issue. And that if there are due process problems, with punitives, that you look at the non-punitive aspect, the part of this case that doesn't involve Philip Morris at all, which is the contract claim, and you look at that under ordinary principles of common law. so that the Philip Morris issues of due process may involve a review of what the procedure was for handling punitive damages. But it doesn't extend to deciding whether or not a new trial on non-punitive issues is required. I believe that that is to be decided under the non-constitutional rulings of this court, which is if the issues are separate. And we've cited cases in our brief that if the court finds a problem with punitive damages, that the new trial should be limited just to punitive damages. We cited to a recent case from Oregon, the Oregon Supreme Court, which is a post-Philip Morris case, addressing very, you know, exactly the same standard. This is the Schwartz case from Oregon, where they decided that the jury instruction was not proper, and therefore what was remanded was only the issue of punitive damages. The rest of the case was upheld.
Well, impound a new jury on punitive damages. Do you have to retry mostly the case? How do you do that?
Well, that's, you have to impound a new jury and you retry the punitive issues. It would involve some duplication because the issues arise from the same common set of facts. But the other part of the case, the findings on what the amount of the compensatory award were, and here, the contract determination, those are completely separate. So there is an exception to this issue of, you know, separate issues that don't have to be retried. And that is if there's bias or passion or prejudice. There is nothing in any of these verdicts to suggest that there was any passion or prejudice that affected these verdicts. Now, if you look at the amount of the compensatory award, Quest has never challenged the amount of that award, either to the trial court or to the Court of Appeals. There's no sign of any passion or prejudice in the contract verdicts. The jury found that Quest did not substantially perform the material terms of the contract. So it was denied on that issue. What was the evidence to support a finding that they didn't substantially perform the contract? The contract said that the owner has to inspect the poles. What was the support for the contract verdict of 100% negligence? The theory against Excel was failure to train. Quest raised that as a theory, but failed to back it up with any evidence at all. So therefore, we ask you to deny the request for a new trial on these other issues. Thank you.
Ms. Kerwin.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's interesting to hear plaintiff's counsel say that there would be plenty of evidence to support this punitive award based on what happened before the accident, because his closing argument to the jury, as quoted by the dissent, was nothing tells you more about the purposely committed conduct than what happened at Quest since June 29, 2004. We would like to have that new trial and test out that theory to find out whether Quest is culpable for actions limited to before 2004. We were denied that trial before. It was telling that plaintiff's counsel admits there is no evidence of actual harm to non-parties at any time, which is absolutely true, and that same admission appears in the briefs. Absent that evidence of actual harm, there's no need for a trial court to balance whether there's evidence of reprehensibility based on actual harm to non-parties. And instead, what the trial court did here was keep out all of the post-accident evidence. And the suggestion that the trial court ultimately concluded based on the opening the door that was achieved in connection with the contract issues that all the evidence was proper is not accurate. At the time Quest moved for mistrial, after the closing argument, after the nothing tells you more argument from plaintiff's counsel, the trial court told the jury, only conduct of Quest that can be considered is that in relation to punitive damages is the conduct prior to the date of the accident. So even at the end of this trial, the trial judge, the person closest to it, was telling the jury, although it was too late, that the only evidence that you should be hearing on punitive damages is pre-accident conduct. But by then, the horse was out of the barn. And you might say, well,
as to that, and maybe that's exactly where you're going, our case law is replete with instances where the court gives a limiting instruction or the court informs the jury not to regard something or to disregard evidence or how to weigh that evidence. And that seems to be a legal fiction that courts apply constantly to correct those sort of trial errors. It seems that your argument that, well, it's not enough, the jury could consider it, you know, would likely consider it anyway, goes against a lot of case law where we ordinarily rely upon the notion that the jury follows the instruction given.
That's where I was headed, Justice Martinez. That's true, but in the People versus Goldsberry case cited in the dissent, case from this court in 1973, the court recognized that when the evidence is so prejudicial that it is outcome determinative, it caused the verdict. Now, that was a criminal case, so they were talking about a finding of guilt. In that instance, then, we will not assume that an instruction would have cured things, and instead we will set aside the result and call for a new trial. That case has not been overruled, and that's exactly why the rationale of the dissent is so important here. The neutral judge, Judge Richmond, analyzing these facts, said that's what we were dealing with here because this evidence was so poisonous. As counsel for plaintiffs admitted in his closing, the key evidence for his case was the post-accident conduct that the trial judge said never should have come in. And that was her solution to trying to implement Philip Morris, and it would have worked. It was Quest's preferred solution because as a trial lawyer, you'd far prefer that a jury never hear about the prejudicial evidence, then hear it, and then be told, please disregard what you've just heard. And so the in limine ruling was the right way to go at it in this case, although you may well conclude that you want to empower trial courts to give limiting instructions when the appropriate Philip Morris situation comes up, and that's the way many federal courts have handled it so far. But in these facts, it was the in limine ruling that should have been fairly enforced and was not, that tainted this entire trial. I also want to mention briefly the Bennett versus Greeley gas case. The law in Colorado, contrary to what plaintiffs just argued, is that evidence of post-accident conduct is not relevant to punitive damages. Now, Bennett is a court of appeals ruling, not a Supreme Court ruling, but you've not overturned that. And the only exception are tiny cases where the evidence of a few days after happens to shed light on what happened at the time of the accident, cases cited in plaintiff's brief. That's not what the justification was here for 3 years of post-accident conduct. And the dissent recognized that Bennett is a critical case to finding the Colorado statute constitutional, in their view, because Bennett prevents a jury from being tainted by post-accident evidence of harm to others. And so we would suggest that you, to the extent you're considering this issue, affirm the ruling in Bennett that under no circumstance should a court be allowing post-accident evidence to reflect on the punitive damage award. Instead, what should happen is you consider what the conduct was of the defendant at the time it caused the injury. We urge you to adopt to implement the holding of Philip Morris as you are required to do, and in this case, to grant a new trial on all issues. We believe that a new trial on punitive damages is not appropriate because there's not enough evidence to support a punitive award, but a new trial on liability and on compensatory damages is necessary for the reasons Justice Martinez articulated in his question. Thank you for your attention to this case.
Thank you for both parties for their arguments. The case will stand submitted. The court will take a 15-minute recess before resuming.